Welcome to Discover Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today we're going to talk to Alex Merkin. I met Alex at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, where we screened his film, This Modern Man Is Beat. And it was a really interesting experience programming This Modern Man Is Beat, because I kept getting emails from the producer and writer where his signature literally says, David J. Schrader, first-time producer, screenwriter, quadriplegic. The film is so good that it won a grand jury prize at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. So you know the drill. Go to discoverfilm.net to watch This Modern Man Is Beat, and then listen to this podcast to hear the interview to find out not just how Alex got to where he is, but how an imaginative screenplay written by a quadriplegic ended up being one of the highlights on the film festival circuit. Okay, let's talk to Alex.
I think that some of my earliest memories, I watch movies with my dad every weekend. So it's one of those things, I grew up seeing everything.
So you were being raised by a film buff.
Yeah, and he's a doctor. He's not he wasn't an artist by any means. My mom actually was, but my father's a psychiatrist, but he just loved going to the movies, and we would go once or twice or three times sometimes on a weekend. And there was never a weekend we didn't go to the movies, but sometimes we go, multiple times. We'd see everything. So back when there was a lot less to see, we'd have seen everything and that was kind of cool.
Was there any singularly inspirational film?
There were two movies I think that were pretty inspiring to me, but I think mostly because of when they sort of came out in my sort of development of understanding what filmmaking was, because I always felt like I wanted to do something in film. I always thought it was writing because I didn't fully understand what directing was, but they're not cinematic masterpieces, but they're good movies. It was Jurassic Park and The Crow when they came out at the time that they did. I was also just getting into a school that was allowing exploration of filmmaking, and I was fascinated by the ways in which a movie like The Crow... I was fascinated by the whole story in the first place and the ways in which they sort of creatively finished that movie and saw it through after the pretty terrible events that happened. And then in Jurassic Park, it was because as a kid, I was a very big dinosaur fan, and I read the book, and I just spent the entire summer excited to see the movie before it came out and imagining how I would make it, and then being disappointed when I first saw it and then learning to love it. And it was a whole sort of experience of just learning sort of filmmaking in that way and making my own little movies and things right around that time.
Yeah. So you were playing with a video camera.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah. As long as I could get my hands on one, they were like magic to me. As soon as you could, capture moving pictures and play them back, it was pretty awesome. And then to just watch how to piece them together, I would do in camera edits until I got to, my freshman year in high school, when I could learn how to do tape to tape. We were doing the tape to tape with video onyx, a little handle, and I loved it. So I sort of didn't look back
right
from that.
You said that was junior high, right? Or no, high school?
That was, so I started right before high school. And then as I got into high school, the high school I went to had a very nice sort of, they would have this arts program where they would make everybody kind of go through all the different forms of art, for 2 weeks, in your freshman year and explore it. And I got to explore directing more. So, and get a better sense of what that actually was, that was.
Right. You were already pretty focused. You were don't waste my time with painting. Let me just play with the camera.
I did do a lot of painting. And I did do a lot of music. And so one of the things I loved about filmmaking was sort of all the different, art forms that it encapsulated. So I just loved having that. Before that, I thought I wanted to act too. So I thought I was interested in acting at one point in my life. And then I was way more interested in the creative process behind it. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So that carried you through high school, and then you...
Did you
make a decision, or was it just hobby at that point?
Well, no. At that point, I was so absolutely sure I was going to make movies with my life that I actually didn't even apply. I only applied to one decent film school because I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and get a rounded education and I'll explore filmmaking in grad school or something because I know I've made like, you know, 20 films in high school. I know that I was the guy that lived in the, you know, in the video and the editing room. And I actually had a teacher who retired when I left because he said he wasn't going to find somebody like this, like passionate again.
Like he'd leaned on you and
it was
and you broke him.
Yeah. I don't know if I broke him. It was like this thing where
in a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. Like he would help sneak me into the school. Like he put his own like job on the line. He'd leave his keys for me in the box so I could get in on the weekends and edit my movies, you know, when I was definitely not allowed to be there. I'd sneak in and go into that little editing room and be editing all weekend. And
were you doing the thing where you're just gathering all your friends together and making them act for you? Or was it like official like
I would come
acting
with,
class stuff?
No, it was never really official. It was always just friends. And I would try to find kind of funny things, you know, teachers that I thought would be interesting or, you know, kids that I thought were interesting and write little stories and things like that around that. And then, yeah. But so when I applied to schools, I didn't apply to a lot of film schools. And then at the last minute, I was like, I can't really be away from this for 4 years. So I chose Boston University because it was the only one that had a good film program that I had applied to. So that's where I ended up. And
right. Yeah. So you went to BU for as a film major?
Yeah. It's in their College of Communications, which was one of the top communication schools there. And
so you dodged a bullet. You almost made that decision to, well, I'll get the standard bachelor's.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, you know, I was so sure I wanted to do it. I was like, why not explore other things in school? You know,
I assume at BU they made you take all the other classes anyway.
Yeah. I thought I would focus on other things and see because it was sort of silly thinking, but it worked out. It worked out all right.
No, so, yeah. It was great.
Yeah. So I went, so after BU, I left and I had a thesis film that, had won some awards and, I took it, I went back to New York and I found a company that was looking for, interns at the time. And I went in really, I was just like, I'll, you know, go to this multimedia production company and just learn and try to start building my own little company from the ground up. And I showed them my film and they really liked it. They offered me actually offered me the head of their film and video position, and they offered me 2% of their company, and it was like it was a whole nice thing.
And that's right out of undergrad.
Right out of undergrad. That was.
By the way, just you said back to New York. So did you grow up?
I grew up in New York. Yes, guy? I grew up in Greenwich Village. So that was a nice place to grow up. I grew up right next to the Quad Cinema, which was and you know in the neighborhood of you know the Angelica and all these other. So I was, like I said, throughout school and everything, I was everything I could see, even the most obscure movies I would go see. So back to New York, I did that. It was a good experience. After about a few months, I was a little frustrated with the sort of jobs that we would sort of have jobs that would be more interesting and creative with less money going into the company because they would go into the budget of the project and you'd end up with a much more creative outcome or projects that were a lot more corporate and financially good for the company and I kept getting kind of forced to lean the other way. So
You were learning about the compromises of the business of film right there.
I was, and I didn't stand for it. I left. I left after 6 months. A couple of the people at the company left with me, and we started our own little production company, doing, you know, a lot of design, graphic design, kind of special effects work, and then moving into music videos and commercial work and things like that. And all the while sort of working towards making my first short film that I wanted to use as like a calling card.
Right. But you set up a company and you actually were getting to direct music videos?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't call them like huge budget anything, you know, but they were, I was doing music, a ton of rap music videos, a nice variety of videos.
But, I mean, there's a lot of really great filmmakers who started with music video.
Yeah.
I think it's the list is impressive.
Yeah, no, you know? Definitely. And it was also a really good time for music videos. It was right before it was at a time when, you know, music videos were like these like little movies that, you know, people still watch them, and they were they weren't just you know, they still played them on MTV and things like that. Yeah. There were a lot of music video shows.
Yeah.
And
yeah, music video had its peak and then it went down, but yeah. Now I feel like YouTube and whatnot's brought it back.
No, for sure. For sure. It's just a completely different landscape, because you can also make them for less money than, you know, they used to be these huge budget.
It's a shoot on film, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, so that was those were sort of my early years there in the industry. And then, I put together a script for a short film that I was really excited about. And, got some producers that I'd been working with to get behind it. And, we eventually got it to a company called First Look Studios, which was a nice sized company. And we were trying to pitch it as something that could be, branded, like naturally branded, like you wouldn't have to change anything about the film itself. It sort of lent itself to branding. It had a lot of cell phone usage in the movie, and it was sort of very reliant on the cell phones. And Samsung actually, was literally right at the time just starting to come out with, video phones. This is right before YouTube was sort of hit. They got behind it, and one of the interesting things that happened with the movie is that it actually ended up all the way up at Warner Independent, and we were being pitched to forget the short film, and here's a very low budget and make it.
But like Samsung came on like throwing in money for product placement?
To produce the short film, to finance the short. Yeah. And so we were sort of getting close to taking the Warner deal, even though it felt like the problem was we had designed it as a short and I hadn't really directed anything that I thought would give me the sort of creative control over a project that, especially at a studio yet. So I really wanted to do it as a short first.
Right. So the talks with Warner was about expanding it
into a feature, like just abandoning the idea of making a short and let's spend some time developing it as a feature. Right. And here's some, right. You know, to do that.
So take the same script and Samsung's backing of it.
No. Samsung was totally
been
separate.
Dropping that.
Right. Well, yeah. Oh. Well, yeah. This is actually the Warner thing happened before we got the
opportunity. Oh, the Warner thing is a different script?
Right. No, it was the same script.
Same script.
But these were sort of separate things that were happening.
So the script was sitting there and there was a fork in the road.
Yeah, there's a fork
and
in the road.
The left
do the
is
Warner.
Samsung
yeah.
short, the right is Warner
exactly.
feature.
So we took the short, right. which was doing the movie.
Because again,
yeah.
I'm picking up the theme, which is creative control
yeah.
matters to you.
Yes, it does, yeah. Well, yeah. especially, you know, when you're showing your sort of first kind of work yeah. as a calling card. And
but like the filmmaker yes. who would have taken the Warner fork probably would have stayed at that company you were at too, right? Like
yeah, that's yeah, just exactly, a different right. person. Exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. No, definitely. I felt it was really important. It's just one of those things where it was like the short was going to get overall less money, but it was still a significant amount of money. And for a short film, it was going to be a lot more money to make a short film than the money to make the feature would be to make a feature. So
right.
you'd be spread
right.
really thin, right. making a feature for the first time, trying to right. turn something that was designed as a short into a feature very
yeah.
quickly. I thought that, you know, it just seemed to make a lot more sense to do the movie the right way as it was intended to be made, you know, with the right
yeah.
sort of look.
Well, and show your capabilities.
Too. Exactly, right. And we got to shoot on 35mm. We got to build a set for it. All because of, you know, the generous Samsung contribution. And we had Adrian Grenier starred in the movie. And this is right after the first season of Entourage had just come out. So he was, you know, at the time was very...
Yeah, he was really
yeah,
hot.
Hot at the time, yeah. And the movie did great. We did this, so we did it as... it was called Across the Hall. And they had planned to do actually much bigger... They were... So Samsung was wanting to market their new video phones with the film, and they were going to release a movie, or they did actually do this in some places where they'd release some of their phone. Half of the movie was on the phone, and then you'd go to the website and download the second half of the movie because it had sort of a natural cliffhanger.
Right, so the phone came preloaded with
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Again, before iPhone and, you know, and, right. and we had all this talk about, you know, 8 minutes.
Oh, it was before the smartphone era?
Oh, yeah.
Was,
yeah, this
oh,
is
really?
Right
so
on the
it,
edge.
So it was on the little screen?
Yeah, it was on these, like, little flip phones or these, like, little, you know, they or they look like, you know, they had multiple phones that played them.
Right.
We had these huge release parties for it and these, like, you know, these,
yeah, well, they premieres. Were really leaning forward there with a flip phone that could record video.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was really, it was very cool. We're always a couple years behind from everything that's going on technologically, but yeah, so that was cool. I mean, and that movie itself, at the time, as I said, I was doing music videos. One of the music videos I'd done was seen by a group called Naughty by Nature. I'm sure you know it, right?
Sure, yeah.
And they were talking about doing some work with me, and they got excited about... They heard about the movie and were excited to watch it, and they loved it, and they had me send it to their manager, who was Queen Latifah's partner. And he watched it over while he was at Mandeville Films with Albert Page and David Hoberman and Todd Lieberman, and I got a call the next day from Mandeville Films, which is, you know, as you know, it's at Disney. It's a very nice size company. And they said, hey, they were like, why haven't we ever heard about you? We just watched your movie with Shaquem Compeer, who's Queen Latifah's partner. And they're like, when are you going to be out in LA? And I lied and I said, next month, which then I booked a ticket and, we set up a meeting, had a really nice meeting. And then after that, I just started getting calls from every agency, every management company. It was a pretty surreal experience. So,
yeah, you were the belle of the ball for a little while.
A little bit. Yeah. It was
a great feeling.
It was a nice feeling. Yeah. It was sitting down with some pretty big
like, people. Were you preloaded? Did you have like, a little
that's
little.
The problem I wasn't
you didn't have like you didn't say okay friends give me five feature ideas give me the long line
but here's the problem the thing is that we weren't even I wasn't even finished editing the movie when this all happened, so we hadn't even hit the festival circuit yet.
So they saw like a rough cut.
Yeah, like they had so Naughty by Nature came over and watched it while it was still in my office, while I was still cutting it. They're like, oh, you got to send this to our manager. And I was like, okay, cool, you know, you do that. And
yeah, no, if you tell them no, give me four weeks,
right? Yeah,
and they're like, yeah, we're doing something else,
right? Exactly. So I did it, and it just sort of spiraled that way. Everybody saw it in the rough form. I was, like I said, I wasn't even, we weren't even locked on picture yet, and so. Yeah, it sort of got ahead of me a little bit, in that sense, but you know,
well, you rode the wave though, which is the right thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so from that, we had a lot of offers to make it as a feature. I was trying to hold out on that for a little while. I was developing some new projects, had some meetings at DreamWorks, had some meetings at like, you know, some pretty cool, like, I got sent two different projects that DreamWorks was developing, which was interesting. And, had this other project that I was writing on spec with a writing partner that we were really excited about. And I remember we finished it, the week that the writer's strike started. And then my agent, William Morris, was like, yeah, we're going to have to sit on this for a while. Nothing's going to really happen. So at that time, I was a little worried that I was always had like the feature version of the short film in my back pocket. It's like an ace card to
play. So you'd already worked out in your head how you would expand it?
Yeah, I already made the script for it, but I just didn't want to... I wanted to do something different and new and not fall back. And I felt like that was something I could fall back... Like, in my mind, let's say I made a first feature and it just... Maybe I had some issues with it or it didn't go great. I could always now pitch my short film that did well as a... You know, I could kind of think... I thought I could maybe fall back on that or... You know, at the very least, that was just some, but I ultimately it wasn't really something I'd already done it. So I wanted to do something new in my heart. I just wanted to do something new. But at the time, like I said, with the writer's strike happening right at the time that we finished this project that was getting a little bit of heat at the time, one of those words, but, I thought the window might be closing to make the short into a feature and there wasn't really anything else I was going to be able to do at the time anyway. And I still had some offers to do that. And so I took one of them and we expanded that as a feature and shot it very, very quickly in 17 days, but we shot it all on the lot at Universal from a company that was located there. And it's a pretty amazing experience for me just to be working on the lot at Universal.
Yeah, my you were a couple years out of school at that point?
Yeah.
And directing on the Universal lot?
Yeah, yeah. It was surreal, riding around in the little golf carts and hanging out on the steps of the Psycho, you know, house, and just, you know, it was pretty cool. And yeah, just to be building our sets on these, like, we got to make our film in a stage that doesn't exist anymore. It was called the Phantom Stage. I think it was stage 24 or stage 28. I can't remember that right now, but it had the old facade of the Phantom of the Opera movie from 1924. All along the outside of the stage, so you could just still see the. So our set was, you know, when you look out of the set, you could see the old Phantom of the Opera House set, which was cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
And it had, you know, it was just such as, you know, Alfred Hitchcock had filmed there, you know, Spielberg, everybody, you know, it's just one of those things that just has this long list of amazing historic films that were made there. And I don't know. It's just I sort of geek out on things like that.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. So that was my first feature. It starred Mike Vogel, Brittany Murphy, and Danny Pino. And then it had a small theatrical run in December of 2009. As we were releasing the movie, as the movie premiered, so we premiered the film, and then 2 weeks after that, Brittany Murphy passed away, and so that was a pretty crazy thing to yeah.
We did discuss this before the mic turned on. It's to deal with loss like that.
Yeah. No, it was and it's hard. It's just it's hard to like. Know how to process all that, you know, at the same time as,
and you care about your integrity and you care about her legacy.
Yeah. And protecting, you know, I'm very protective of actors anyway on set. So, I think it's one of those things that, you know, you just don't, it was a really weird and difficult sort of time. Yeah.
I mean, releasing a film is one of the most stressful things you can go through.
Yeah.
And then to have that happen to your lead.
Yeah.
Insane.
Totally insane. Yeah. It's weird. I mean, it was literally her last like public appearance for, you know, and premiere. A couple of years ago, I was on a plane watching on Lifetime had a Brittany Murphy like movie, a movie about her life, and they were depicting my premiere in the. It was just a weird like.
I am sure that at the time I read about when I was reading the articles about it. I'm sure about her passing. I'm sure I read about your film.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Yeah,
I'm sure they said like the last thing she did, which is you know.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean she was filming other. She'd filmed other things. This was the last movie that. Was out in theaters and that right. She had done a
right. You know, so there was right. More in the can.
There was more in the can.
Well, so how after that?
Yeah.
Because you know, we gotta move past.
Sure,
it, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
especially for your sake, I wouldn't want you to get
for sure.
You know, tragedy for 30 minutes,
let's please.
But so what happened for you next? Like after that. After that storm passed, because it did it feel like a storm? I assume.
Yeah, it definitely felt like a storm. There was a lot of activity at the time, a lot of things happening, positive and negative, and it was very hard to sort of process any of it. Yeah. So,
You're still New York based and flying out here, or you moved?
Yeah, I was still New York based. I was starting to be a little more bi-coastal at the time, and eventually ended up, you know.
And you're in your mid-20s.
Yeah, exactly.
So, bi-coastal in your mid-20s. Exactly. It's got to be that's a lot to manage.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do think in some ways I ended up making the full move a little late. I sort of waited a little longer than I probably should have, but, you know, in hindsight.
But you were born and raised.
Right, exactly. That's true. So, But so after that, I ended up doing a couple projects. I guess started getting offers for I was trying to develop my next sort of original film. At the same time,
right, because at that point you were a feature director,
right? And then I got an offer for a really interesting project that was totally like unlike anything I'd done and it was a chance to work with HBO, and it was a full season of a show, but it was in a very weird space and time. What was weird is it was this show for Cinemax called Girls Guide to Depravity, but at the time they were just sort of coming out of the let's start to make more original content for that and for Cinemax, and they weren't, the branding for it wasn't really out yet, and we were sort of in this very weird space. And I remember it's one of those things that's really interesting because producers came to me and were very, you know, I mean, it was a very exciting project in the sense that it was a comedy, it was a sort of edgy comedy for it, working with HBO, working very closely with the executives over there, and you know, this all new content. It was edgy, and I was a little nervous about doing something edgy that was going to be on Cinemax at the time, and.
Because Cinemax was associated with softcore type stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And there was a lot of sex and nudity on the show, but it wasn't a softcore thing. And I was worried it was going to be in that sort of like... Because people hadn't really seen original content on Cinemax before.
You didn't want to get Red Shoe Diaried?
Right. It was an interesting scenario. I loved making the show and working on it. And I do think, you know... We got into a situation in post-production where we were sort of pushed not to make it that, but to a little past what we had been told when we started. You know what I'm saying? There are places where it's like, all right,
I understand.
You start to see these sort of behind the scenes of like how a lot of sex and nudity ends up on every Cinemax show, on every HBO show. You just see a lot of that stuff, right? So
people joke a lot about the Westworld Game of Thrones battle of breasts.
Right,
who's
exactly.
Show more bare breasts.
Right. Or it's not porn, it's HBO. It's like that kind of thing, right? Where, yeah. So,
yeah, no, it's art if it's on HBO.
Right.
But if it's on Cinemax.
But if it's on Cinemax, especially at the time, it's like, you know, it was a... But at the same time, I had the chance to sort of...
That's a great opportunity for you.
Yeah, work and direct an entire series. Like, not
right.
just
like
do
10
a couple
episodes?
Episodes
or
13
more.
Episodes.
13 episodes. So that was the first thing that came after Brittany Murphy was the
no, I had,
show?
No, there were offers for things, but... you know, there were offers for other movies, but it was sort of this thing where I wanted to make money and do something that was sort of... very different from what I was doing because I didn't want to do, I was trying to develop some original content that I was excited about. I didn't want to come out with sort of do something that was more like a watered down version in the same sort of wheelhouse of that space. I don't know if I'm making sense. It's like, you don't really want to do so we just did a thriller. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do another thriller that I'm less enthusiastic about.
Right.
Even though I might have a bigger budget, but I just don't love the script or I don't love the...
Right. I mean, if you've been given a thriller that you
loved,
spoke to you,
yes,
then 100%. It would have been no problem.
Yeah. Well, that was my original thing. When you start out, you're very precious about everything that you're going to take.
Yeah.
You're precious about all the material. And then at a certain point, you sort of like break the seal on being precious about things. And I think actually doing the show was a very eye-opening experience for me because I could see how to become passionate about material that I
right.
wasn't originally passionate
right.
about.
So two
material.
Seasons working for HBO Cinemax.
Right.
And that was the learning experience you needed to
exactly
to be a little more macro.
Right. And take on things where I'm like, and be more open to projects where it might not be a perfect script. It might not be a perfect, you know, you just can't dictate what you're going to get
right.
all the time and when you're going to be able to make your passion projects. So, learning to just find the art and the passion in the work that you're doing and doing great work, you know, even if it's not a film that, you know, that you would have originally looked at. It's like, you know, you just, what you're able to accomplish and what you're able to do with the actors and the interesting moments and things that you can do on projects like that, and just and working and learning and continuing to learn on set. I love to work. I'd rather, you know, I just rather be on set than sitting around, you know, taking meetings all day.
No, it's really fun.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I mean, and to compliment you, I mean, so many people come out of school and would like to be a working director.
Right.
And you actually were.
Yeah. No,
which is a huge accomplishment.
Thank you. Yeah. No, it's really nice to be paid well for what you love to do and to be on set and to be in, you know, in casting sessions and to be in the editing room and to be, I still pinch myself when I'm realize that I get paid to do these things. And that's, you know, and it's things that I've wanted to do for as long as I can remember wanting to do anything.
And out of curiosity, did you completely drop music video? You left that company behind in a way?
Sort of. Well, yeah, that company that I started, I did sort of dissolve the company that I did. I mean, I very recently just did a music video that was sort of a promotional thing for a film that a friend of mine asked me to do for A&E and Lifetime. That was kind of fun. We did it for the holidays, and it was actually kind of cool. It had its own little, like,
right
block on the TV guide for music. But yeah, so I didn't fully, but yeah, I sort of left.
But you weren't like continuing. You didn't come to LA and start saying, I'll direct a couple music videos a year while I pursue other things. You were solely just focused on film
and TV.
Film
and TV. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so after that, I was asked I told you that Queen Latifah's business partner, Shakim, had been one of the sort of early people. At the start of my career in Queen Latifah, and Shakim had been very supportive of me, and I have done a few things where I'd been flown to Miami with them, and we'd done some like intensive like workshop on developing projects for Queen Latifah and other, you know, another in their company and other things that they were working on.
Yeah, they've made a couple features.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Shakim told me he was building a studio in Miami. They were going to open a studio and sort of like what he was inspired by, what Tyler Perry was doing in Atlanta. And he had his own, he bought a stage, his own sound stage, and he was sort of building this whole thing out. And he asked me to come out and work with him for a little bit. And I did. And I went out and made two films with them.
So you did the two features in Miami.
Right.
And then you came back?
I came back. And then after that experience, I turned down a lot of things because I was just really unhappy about the way the.
Right. But you wanted to make, so the next one you wanted to be the right.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I sort of got back to a place where I was, you know, being a little, I sort of let down my guard where I was like not being precious at all. And then I got to the place where I was being overly precious again. And just like, I'm not going to do anything unless it's, and really what I was looking for was, I was looking for the right team more than the right project. Looking for producers that I could really like trust and believe in. And who I felt were going to give me the opportunity to really like, so I did turn down projects that had, I guess, higher budgets that I was a little more concerned about the team that was in place for other projects. And I ended up doing a movie with, has a very young producer who, he sold me well on what he really intended to do. And, I won't necessarily say it's everything that we were sold, but it was a fun project. It was a movie called Altitude, and it came out from Lionsgate. It was in theaters in April, last April. And we got to work with Dolph Lundgren, who was really fun to work with. And it turned out fun, I thought, and people seemed to enjoy it. And,
right. So Altitude was your first thing back from Miami.
Back from Miami. Right. So it was my fourth feature.
Fourth feature.
Yeah. And I know it's been a wild, yeah. So that was in April. That movie came out in April. And then, I accepted a movie with, Mar Vista, shortly after that. Cause I met, a producer named Neil Elman, who I absolutely loved. And, this is the kind of guy that I was sort of always looking for in a producer. Just totally gets it. He's creative, understands the business side, understands the creative side. We did a movie in Kentucky. We did horror. It was actually my first horror film. And, that was called House of the Witch. And that had a little limited theatrical, and then it was premiered on Sci-Fi in October. And then shortly after that, I did another movie with Dolph Lundgren, but a comedy now, holiday film that because we just got along and had a really nice time. Has a pretty nice cast. We're still in post on that.
Right. But so you actually created a rapport with him.
Yeah.
And was this one something he brought to you or you brought to him?
It was sort of like right in the, I mean, we were in contact with each other as we were like, both kind of like, let's do it. We'll do it together. Yeah. You know, and it was kind of a fun thing. And it was a very different kind of character that I've ever seen him play. And he was great at it. And it was, and it's got Keith David, Nick Turturro. It's a really fun cast. And, I think it's a fun movie. That's in post now. And then shortly after that, I did a psychological thriller, again, with the same producer that I did the Witch movie with. Mm-hmm. And that's also in post right now, called Framed.
Those are three from last year.
Yeah, three from last year.
And so I got to ask, because I met you because of This Modern Man Is Bee, how did that one pop in? 2 years ago, I assume. You probably made it.
I made that while I was between, right before I did Altitude. That was in that period where I was like, I really want to sort of cleanse my soul of the, creative process I had. You know, it's one of those things where
back and make a short exactly the way you want.
Yeah. Make the movie that I want to make and have the control. And a writer named David Schroeder, contacted me. He had seen my previous work, my previous short, my previous feature, Across the Hall. Just a really talented guy, very interesting, very passionate. He'd been trying to make this movie for 5 years. And it was one of the most interesting and strange scripts I've ever read. And I loved his story and I loved his passion. And I really was so, it was almost like reading a poem, you know, reading the script was like reading a poem. It's hard to explain. There's like, there was intentional misspellings and word phrases that just made you look at them, in a way.
So he was really manipulating the language.
Yeah. He was manipulating the language, but it left a lot of space.
Wheelchair bound.
Yes. Right? Yeah. For the past 40 years. And, worked so hard.
I say that because every time he sent me an email, he always mentions it.
He was just the kind of guy that, like, you know, when he was putting this together, I know that he was in a wheelchair and at one point run over in a parking lot and refused any pain medication because he just wanted to keep writing and keep working. And it's just, he's such a driven guy and such a sweet hearted and, just a pure, you know, like cinephile and, someone who just loves the art of making movies and wanted to, he just never had anything produced. And, so got involved with it. And yeah, I did have to do a lot. I mean, there wasn't really a visual, there were just things that just made the created visual concepts in my mind, but they weren't written. They weren't built into the script. It was just sort of the way it was written. It was a lot in the negative space. A lot of what wasn't written that allowed the mind to sort of flourish. And it's one of the reasons why I really loved the idea of it. And I obviously loved some of the themes of redemption and sort of the gray space that a lot of people exist in that don't, you know, that we don't explore a lot. Everything tends to be very black and white even in our everyday life, the way we view, you know, the news, things tend to be very black and white. And, it was very interesting to me explore,
Right, so it spoke. So right when you read the script, it just spoke to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And did he? He's producer. Although there's many producers listed. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I brought on some producers of my own because he had not produced before, and I needed some support from people that I trusted to help.
But in a way, you took over and you were the driving force to get it made.
Right. Yeah. But without a doubt, he was the driving force in getting it financed. I was the driving force in getting it, it's actually a very good sort of executive producer, director relationship in the sense that it needed a voice and it needed some focus to get it, you know, streamlined into how we're going to make this into a production, where we're going to shoot it. At first, he's from Miami and a lot of his resources were in Miami. And at first we talked about making it in Miami, but that felt like a very lush, sort of the wrong environment for me to make this story. And he agreed pretty quickly. And also it's not the kind of place you look at and think Americana, like barren Americana sort of, right, dreamscape, right? The dream gone wrong in a way, right? And you can't really look at that in Miami.
It's desolate.
Right. And that's what I really felt we needed for the film. So we found, you know, we ended up pulling our resources in LA and shot up in the high desert over there, at the, it's called the Four Aces. I'm sure you've seen that set before. That's actually a full film. It's not a real motel, but that's a full film set.
Really?
Yeah. Which is cool.
It's just the official rundown motel.
Yeah.
Set.
Yeah. It's used a lot in commercial work. But it's a really just a very cool space. It's just, you know, it was built by production designers and just has that. And it's in a really sort of perfect location for a story like this. And then we also shot the pawn shop scene. We shot a couple pawn shop scenes. Two of them didn't make the film, but that one was from Pulp Fiction, actually.
I remember you saying that at the Q&A.
Yeah, so yeah. That was really fun to shoot. They don't have the basement. They don't have the GIMP basement, but
there is no basement.
No, I know. I know. There aren't a lot of locations left from Pulp Fiction, but it was fun to shoot in that one. So yeah, it was great. And again, yeah, that for me was, it was a meditation on filmmaking and I love that experience and that was
the film itself is a meditation.
I mean, for me, the process. I would say the process was for me. So
his wife doesn't represent the film.
No. Yeah,
and the director must strangle it.
No, but that's interesting. It's an interesting.
Yeah, I'm just stretching it.
Yeah, no.
I'm just playing film school professor.
Yeah, I like it.
Pull shit out of the ass.
I like it. No, it's good. The process of doing that, and it's been beautiful to see it sort of take the life it has, and I've been really grateful to be a part of it. So
I had a really good festival run, and
super
then,
great.
Yeah. And you were, in spite of shooting three features last year, you actually had time to go to a couple festivals.
I did. Yeah. I had time to go to a few, and now I'm back in the editing room, finishing up the two of the movies that I made, and getting ready to do. I've already signed on to a new one, which I'm actually extremely excited about, and I can't say too much about it yet. It's the biggest project I've done to date, and it's about a very well-known
great
figure. It's a biopic, but it's
I can probably see it on IMDb Pro, but you don't have to mention that.
Okay, well, it might be there, but yeah.
You know, it's funny. I didn't look you up, so I, you know, it's all new to me.
Oh, that's
everything
cool.
You're telling me.
That's cool.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I've had anyone in here with your kind of credits. So you know, most of the time, you know, I'm like, you know, everybody else who's short played in these festivals is like hoping to make a feature someday.
Yeah.
And you are this auteur at heart who's making features. And right. You said, you know what? To satisfy my heart, I'm going to do an auteur short.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And I try to stay in that space, because until I can do that in the same space as my future, I just want to keep, I can't stop that passion. And it is weird. It's funny because, I just remember my producer who I, like I said, the one I told you about recently, who I'm working with now a lot, who he's just, I mean, honestly, I love the guy. And he'll say to me, I see you like killing yourself for this movie, and this is not the movie to kill yourself over. Like, just let some of this stuff go. I see how it's killing you. I see the artist in you. I see it, but like, let's just let some of that part go. Let this go. Yeah. And cause I do sort of end up killing myself over things that people will just never have any idea.
Right. Like, so he has that perspective.
Like, yeah. And he'll sit there and go, I know. He's like, I love you. I love that you're an artist. I love that you live and die by this, and you will absolutely like pour your heart out into this, but just like, this is not the movie. Like, save that for the next one that we're going to do. And just let's get this, let's, you know, wrap this up.
He sounds like my kind of guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. He's great. He's a great guy. So
I remember saying to a producer many times in the editing bay, thing, I go, you really think like changing this cut's going to sell the film?
Right.
Like, are we going to make more money if we do it your way?
Right. And that's,
and the answer is of course not.
Right.
You're just, you know, yeah. Have you heard the old, I'll use the word director instead of screenwriter, but you hear about the director and the producer who were their car crash and they're on their hands and knees in the desert, and they get up to a pond, and just as the director's about to scoop water into his mouth, he looks and the producer's pissing in it. And he goes, "What are you doing?" And the producer says, "Don't worry, I'm making it better."
That is awesome. And that is often very true.
I was told that joke as screenwriter producer.
It's so true,
but
though.
Don't worry, I'm making it better. Like, I have to put something of me
yes,
in it.
Yes, I need to be in this. I am, it's about me. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, that happens. And it does. It is a rare producer that sort of knows how to separate themselves from it, knows how to sort of evaluate when to fight for this and when to fight for that.
I wonder if, but I heard Darren Aronofsky interviewed just like the last 2 days. I heard his interview on What the Fuck with Marc Maron.
Uh-huh.
And he's producing a bit now, and he sounds it sounds like, you know, a working director or an ex-director is going to make a great producer because he's going to understand. I'm being very gender specific, aren't
right.
I?
Right.
But like you have a producer who understands, I don't need to put myself into this.
Right, right. No, totally. Yeah. And what's funny is he's also a writer, and he is passionate about the creative process. He just understands where he's needed, and he understands where he's not. And he doesn't, and he really gets it. And I don't always agree with, we butt heads at times, but I respect everything he says, and I love the perspective that he adds for me, and I'll come away and I'll just go, yeah, I'm happy with these changes, even though I fought them.
That's great. Is he one of the guys whose name is on the Modern Man is Beat?
No, you know what? No, I just got very lucky and met him last year. And it's one of the best things for me that came out of making the movie Altitude, because one of the producers on that film connected me with this person when he was looking for a director to make this movie that they had to go make in Kentucky. Very quickly, they were finding lots of directors they didn't like, and they sent him my stuff, and we immediately vibed and got together, and it happened very, very quickly. And he's just
sounds great. I mean,
he's
there's awesome. No doubt that partnerships are what get things done.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, even if you look at Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, right? I mean, neither guy would be where he is without the other.
No, it's true. Totally. I've definitely always wanted to have a producer like this in my corner and working with them and learning like in some ways mentoring, because I've never really felt like I had that myself. And I definitely felt like I found that with this. He's been involved with so many projects, you know, in the past, and he just, you know, and he's got a great bullshit meter, and he knows great work, and he knows work that's right. Not.
So he's been around long enough too that he understands when to be precious and when,
right.
And when to
completely.
When to not.
No, he's great.
I have to tell you, someday I'm going to have to release the secret basement tapes of the Discover Film podcast, because Alex and I talked about so many other subjects. I mean, I had to edit them out so this thing is less than a few hours, but man, did we cover a lot of ground. And I got to say, there's nothing that I enjoy hearing more than the fact that even though Alex is a working director, making lots of commercial films, he still takes time out of his schedule to just do a work of art, just a cinematic short that's beautiful, that he has complete control of, so he can satisfy the artist in himself while he continues to work in Hollywood. Okay, well, let's wrap this up. Go to discoverfilm.net so that you can watch This Modern Man Is Beat, and then you should also watch all the other great shorts that are there, and you should also use the links to all the great feature films you can watch. And, of course, at discoverfilm.net, you can also check out the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and Film Invasion LA. And you can learn about me, your film festival programmer and podcast host. And I think that's it. Thanks for listening.